again. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the election of Donald Trump to be president. We also this hour will talk more about Ron Johnson's victory over Russ Feingold for the U.S. Senate yesterday. We'll have a lot of guests with us this hour. Sean Johnson will kick off the hour, State Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio. Ruth Conniff will be here, Editor-in-Chief of the Progressive Magazine. Ari Berman, who's been doing a whale of a job reporting on voter suppression for The Nation magazine. He is in Madison now. He's done a lot of work on what's going on in Wisconsin and North Carolina as well. He's the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Orrin Cass, senior fellow of the Manhattan Institute, who was domestic policy director of Mitt Romney's presidential campaign. And Kathleen Dolan will also join us, professor and chair of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee Department of Political Science. So we have a full roster this hour, and we'll be welcoming phone calls at 800-486-8655. And we start with Sean. Hello, Sean. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. Well, you've had Wisconsin politicians figure prominently, of course, nationally, and some of them were on the fence, kind of sat out the election. But you wonder now, considering how prominent these people are nationally, Republicans from Wisconsin, where do they fit into a Trump administration? Are we going to see Governor Walker appointed to something? Reince Priebus? Paul Ryan, I guess, is saying that he's going to run again and run hard to be speaker still. But what's going to happen with our politicians here?
Yeah, right now you're just in the wild speculation phase. So already you're seeing just kind of names being thrown out there as people who might be in a Trump cabinet. One of the names that was thrown out today, for example, Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark.
Really?
Was floated in an article by Politico to be Homeland Security Secretary. So, again, just really wild speculation at this point. But we do know that David Clark was a very vocal Trump surrogate. And then you look at Reince Priebus, who, you know, started out as Wisconsin's chair of the Republican Party here, the RNC chair, who worked to help get Trump elected. People are talking about him as a potential chief of staff for a President Trump. So, you know, there are names out there. I haven't seen Governor Walker's name featured in any of those speculation articles today. That's not to say that it won't be there at some point, because he also spoke on behalf of Trump at the convention. And while his support for him was on again, off again, you know, he was ultimately in Trump's corner.
Yeah, and Trump said a lot of nice things about him toward the end of the campaign. He's doing a good job, you know?
A lot of nice things toward the end of the campaign. A lot of not-so-nice things
earlier,
while
yeah.
the campaign was
exactly.
still going on. I mean, while the primary was happening in Wisconsin, he belittled, you know, Scott Walker. When Governor Walker left the presidential campaign, without mentioning Trump by name, he essentially said, we need to rally around somebody who's an alternative to the current frontrunner. That was Donald Trump at the time. It didn't happen, and here we are today.
Hmm. I hadn't thought about David Clark. That's interesting. There's probably no doubt that he's going to be asked to do something in the administration, don't you think? Speaking circuit for him quite a bit.
He's been on the speaking circuit for a while. I mean, before Donald Trump, he's become a Fox News personality, really. And, you know, so whether or not he has a formal role in the administration or not, he's become a very vocal Trump surrogate. And, you know, he shares a style with Trump, really. He gets very personal with his political enemies in a way that Donald Trump does. And Clark has actually mentioned that, too, that he kind of likes Trump's style.
Mm. Well, what happened to the Democrats in Wisconsin? Did it make a difference that Hillary Clinton didn't show up to campaign? She had surrogates, but she didn't come to Wisconsin. They thought they had it, didn't they?
They did, and if you look at polling, they had good reason to think that they had it.
Yeah.
I mean, we look at the Marquette poll because it's been so, you know, correct here. It's been so on the money in other races, at least in picking the winner, has been pretty close on the margins, too. And the last Marquette poll had Hillary Clinton up by 6 in Wisconsin. The previous one had her up by 7. She never trailed Donald Trump in the Marquette poll. And she felt so good about it. Not only did she not show up here, this is actually one of the, I think, maybe the only battleground state where Donald Trump aired more TV ads than Hillary Clinton did. So there was definitely a feeling of confidence from the Clinton campaign. People will be second-guessing that, of course. I mean, she didn't pay a visit here in at any point. You know, you can imagine a visit by Hillary Clinton or a President Obama in the closing days could have potentially provided some movement for them. It didn't happen. That ended up being a pretty close race. I mean, you're talking about 26, 27,000 votes separating her from Donald Trump. So much closer than the U.S. Senate race.
Yeah. So his Rust Belt strategy, if he planned it or people who worked for him or it was just a gut feeling, who knows with that campaign, seemed to work for him. Tell me about the Rust Belt unhappiness. What's going on in Michigan and Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, all these states that Donald Trump won?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure that we completely understand it, but these are states with changing economies. They're states where, you know, Donald Trump's message perhaps on immigration and talking about building a wall clicked. I mean, we looked at Wisconsin. People looked at Wisconsin pretty early out and looked at the demographics here and said, hey, that looks like it might be a Trump state. We got a large concentration of white voters here, a lot of blue-collar voters. It seemed like that might match up with Trump. In the early going, in our primary, it didn't. You know, he was not well-received here. He was not well-received in southeast Wisconsin. Ted Cruz was in the primary. It looked like all year maybe southeast Wisconsin wouldn't come home for Trump, but they did. I mean, he got about the same number of votes as Mitt Romney did in 2012. Different concentrations. I mean, he didn't have quite the support that Romney did in southeast Wisconsin, but he made up for it elsewhere. I mean, Donald Trump did pretty well in western Wisconsin. He did pretty well in northeast Wisconsin in the Green Bay media market. So he changed the map, but at the end of the day, he got about the same number of votes as did Mitt Romney in 2012. The difference is Hillary Clinton underperformed Barack Obama's 2012 totals rather substantially, and so she didn't have enough to overcome that.
Mm-hmm. And were there certain parts of the state, I keep thinking about Milwaukee because that's where we are, were Milwaukee numbers pretty bad for her?
I mean, she was lower in Milwaukee. There was a time last night, we kept looking at those Milwaukee numbers over and over again last night, and actually Milwaukee didn't add its absentee ballots to the total until pretty late, so it ended up being closer than it looked like early on. Milwaukee's one county where clearly she underperformed President Obama. You go down to other counties that are kind of bellwether counties, Kenosha County. I mean, a Democrat, there's really no history of a Democrat losing Kenosha County in Wisconsin in a presidential year. And the Democrats did yesterday. You look in western Wisconsin. Mm. You know, Trump did very well in a number of smaller rural counties there. Northern Wisconsin, he was popular in Sean Duffy's congressional district. So it was more of a patchwork support than somebody like Mitt Romney, which was all concentrated in southeast Wisconsin, or more concentrated there.
Let's take a few phone calls for you. 800-486-8655 is our number. David in New Richmond. Hi, David.
My question for the guest was, are you surprised that maybe the third parties didn't do any better than they did, seeing how the two choices weren't really that good? And even the third party, those two choices weren't that good either. But I was thinking maybe some people would vote just because it certainly showed we could use some more choices in this country. And regarding the Feingold-Johnson thing, I think the average Wisconsin voter looked at Russ Feingold as wanting to come back and be a professional politician. And Wisconsin's getting tired of that, I think, and are looking more for people that want to serve some time, and then somebody else could be qualified to do the job. And I think Mr. Feingold found that being in the private life is a lot tougher than being in a political position.
Yeah, we haven't talked very much about that race. Feingold's loss.
Yeah, Feingold's loss, you could kind of, looking back, you could see that trend happening where Feingold led in every poll. Again, the value of those polls now, we got to kind of question, given the number of people that basically weren't counted, I guess. But Ron Johnson sort of steadily closed on Feingold. You saw a lot of Feingold's national support drift off to other states to try to expand the map. And in the meantime, Republicans led by, Diane Hendricks, a Wisconsin billionaire, just dumped a lot of money into advertising in this race and, whittled away his advantage. I think if you look at Feingold's message over the last month, I think there's some room for second guessing there. Having covered a lot of the Feingold stops, his message was basically, twofold. I mean, he was talking about early voting at every stop, and then he would also talk about how his opponent supports Donald Trump. In the end, Ron Johnson started saying the same thing. He started campaigning with Donald Trump's son, adopting Donald Trump's drain the swamp phrase. It didn't end up being a liability for him.
Thanks, David, for the call. Let's go to Phil in Madison. Hi, Phil.
Hey, I can tell you right now exactly what happened is that Americans are so sick and tired of the polite platitudes from professional politicians that they chose rude honesty and a crass style over the same old do nothing but serve yourself and get yourself elected politicians. And that's why Clinton and Feingold were so handily defeated.
Mm. Does the crassness bother you, Phil?
The crassness does bother me. It is against my style. I enjoy listening to your program because it is a little bit more cerebral. And I enjoy sitting around having a cup of coffee or a beer and having a discussion about issues. But these days, people get so easily offended so quickly, and politics becomes so personal that is the style. It is the reality TV style
right, that
we have inculcated into our culture.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I just don't watch much reality TV, so I guess all of that kind of escaped me. Your comments on that, Sean?
Well, there were people who didn't like the crassness but said, I'm going to support him anyway. I mean, a lot of this, for me at least,
right, is
based on just anecdotal interviews with people at rallies, et cetera. They'd say, I don't really like some of the things he says, but I want somebody that's going to shake things up. He's the guy. There are also people who liked the crassness, though, liked it a lot. And, that was evident, too, when you just anecdotal interviews around these rallies.
Yeah, going to some of those rallies, you could see that at play, right? But the other thing that was happening is when those acts of the women came forward accusing him of predatory behavior, when the Access Hollywood tape came up, his poll numbers plummeted. Then we got, the email, her email, which surfaced again. But we had wild fluctuations in polls right before, in the last month. You couldn't really tell where this was going, although it didn't seem to be going his way.
No, I mean, conventional wisdom said that after that tape came out, the Access Hollywood tape came out, and you saw his numbers tank, a lot of people said, that's it. And it was one of many cases over the course of the long campaign where a lot of people said, okay, that's going to be the end of Donald Trump. That's going to sink
right, him.
I think that was the most prominent example. It happened close enough to the election day that it seemed like that would probably be it, that would do him in. It didn't.
Mm-hmm.
It ended up being a footnote, which is kind of amazing.
Yeah, the whole thing is pretty amazing. I mean, the whole election is pretty amazing. And finally, from Facebook, Wendy says sends this message. Sean, we'll get your response and then move on to many other people analyzing the candidates. Listening to your show this afternoon while driving, just got home. Did it ever occur to anyone, Wendy asks, that the reason or says Trump won has nothing to do with demographics? How about people everywhere were just sick and tired of politicians not representing them on issues that were of importance to them?
Yeah, I think there's this idea that maybe we need to get used to that. I think everyone's well aware that government, especially government in Washington, is not too popular. We've known that for a while. We've known that there's a resentment toward government out there by a lot of people. But I think a lot of us have viewed that as one factor among many in the way that people view their government. Maybe we're not giving it enough weight. Maybe that is the factor that we need to be looking at, is that sort of resentment
Right.
that exists out there in the United States and in Wisconsin specifically, because it seems to have worked here.
Sean, thanks ever so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Sean Johnson is Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol Bureau Chief. We're going to continue. We have many other analysts with us, great longtime political observers as we continue. And we want to tell you that tomorrow at this time, we will be switching focus. The second hour, we'll have a special Veterans Day show and hear from three veterans from three different wars who just last weekend participated in an honor flight to Washington, D.C. So that's coming up tomorrow, a special Veterans Day show, hour two of our show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I know how disappointed you feel because I feel it too. And so do tens of millions of Americans who invested their hopes and dreams in this effort. This is painful, and it will be for a long time. But I want you to remember this. Our campaign was never about one person or even one election. It was about the country we love and about building an America that's hopeful, inclusive, and big-hearted. We have seen that our nation is more deeply divided than we thought. But I still believe in America, and I always will. And if you do, then we must accept this result and then look to the future. Donald Trump is going to be our president. We owe him an open mind and the chance to lead. Our constitutional democracy enshrines the peaceful transfer of power. And we don't just respect that, we cherish it.
Hillary Clinton giving her concession speech, and a gracious one it was, mid-morning today. We will get our guest's response, and we have a number of guests joining us now this remainder of our program. In our studios here in Milwaukee, Kathleen Dolan, professor and chair of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's Department of Political Science. She's been with us quite a few times during this very long election season. Professor Dolan, thanks very much for being with us again.
Sure, happy to be here.
Also joining us from our studios in Madison, Ruth Conniff, editor-in-chief of the Progressive magazine, and she has been covering progressive politics for a long time. She started as a political writer working with Irwin Noel. Ruth, thanks for being with us again. Hi.
Glad to be with
you. Yeah, nice to have you here. Ari Berman is with us. Ari is in Madison as well, senior contributing writer for The Nation magazine. He is the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, and he's done some exceptional work on voter suppression and purging of the ballots in North Carolina. We'll talk to him about that, and he's been investigating Wisconsin and other states as well. Ari, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi,
thanks
Ari.
For having me back.
Yeah, thank you. And Oren Cass is also joining with us. Oren is senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He was domestic policy director of Mitt Romney's presidential campaign in 2011 and 2012. Oren, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks
Hi.
For having me.
Yeah, thank you. I just want to know how the rhetoric, particularly, I must say, in the Donald Trump side, when you had a lot of lock her up supporters, there's been a lot of vitriol. There's been comments made about certain groups in this country. And we're going to listen to what Van Jones said, which is making its rounds on Facebook in various places this afternoon. But there have been a lot of people who have been concerned about the rhetoric of the Republican campaign, maybe the lack of excitement about the Democratic campaign, but really a change in policy, a build the wall, deport people who are here illegally. Don't allow Muslims to come into the country. There's been a lot of that, and people are worried about huge policy shifts as a result of this election. How do we have a peaceful transition of power when you have something that could be a radical change? So I'm asking probably three questions in one. Do you expect that there will be a peaceful transition? Do you expect that there will be a dramatic change in policy and that it's going to be very hard to get the country together because of complete differences on a lot of policies? Professor Dolan, we'll start with you.
excuse me, yes, yes, and yes. We will have a peaceful transition of policy. Secretary Clinton made a gracious speech this morning. President Obama made a gracious speech as well, has a meeting already scheduled with President-elect Trump for tomorrow. There is no reason to doubt that we won't continue our historical patterns of peaceful transitions of power. Might there be wild swings or dramatically different policy? There may be. We're not sure because we know relatively little about President-elect Trump's specific policy proposals. So the policies will be in part generated by the people he brings in around him and his working relationship with Congress, which certainly is pretty conservative. And then I think the third piece of your question, which I answered yes to and have now forgotten.
I've forgotten it a long time ago. It's okay. You can start with the great answer you already gave. Thank you. Orrin, what do you think about that? How is this going to go peacefully, smoothly?
Well, I think it will go peacefully like it's always gone peacefully. I don't see any reason you would expect anything different in this case. I imagine you'll have some protesters around the inauguration, but that would hardly be unprecedented either. And then with respect to the policy swings, I think we have a perfectly good reference point for this, which is 2008, where you have a switch of parties in the White House after a two-term president combined with unified control of the House and the Senate. And in that case, you know, incoming President Obama had a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. And even then, remember how long it took to do Obamacare, how long it took to do Dodd-Frank.
Yes. These
things don't go quickly, even within the Republican Party. There's obviously a huge amount of disagreement on a lot of the issues. And so I think we'll see the kind of probably blockbuster policy changes go in very much the way that they've gone during past political swings.
And Ruth, the president reminded us in his speech today in front of the White House that he came to office and it was coming after George Bush, and they had wildly different ideas about what policy would be. It was a change. It was a big change, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think women in pantsuits are going to be storming the inauguration. I mean, I think,
right,
you know, we might be talking about peaceful transition of power with more anxiety if it had gone the other way. That was really the worry, right? That at the polls, people were ready to show up with guns to make sure there wasn't voter fraud. That's not going to happen now. In fact, what's interesting is that Trump is no longer an outsider. The Republicans are going to control
everything.
They're running the table. They can't present themselves any longer as the underdog in a rigged system that's designed to keep them out. So, you know, we'll see what he does. We don't know. We're really in uncharted territory. He hasn't articulated many policy positions. Mm-hmm. It's just going to be great. That's all we really know. Mm-hmm. I mean, the violence, the threats of violence, the ugliness, the ugly rhetoric make it a really discouraging moment. And I just flew back from Washington where I spent election night and took a cab past the brand new African-American Museum of History on the way in on a beautiful day on Tuesday and on the way out in the rain today. And, you know, just the overwhelming sense of how can we be at this point in history after two terms of the first African-American president is pretty heavy.
The irony of that meeting tomorrow, it just can't be. I keep seeing it in my mind and we'll never hear the conversation, but Donald Trump coming to the White House to hear from President Obama about how everything works to begin the transition of power. And here's the guy who said that it did the whole birther movement, Ari. I mean, it's just incredible, isn't it?
It's hard to fathom, and I can't imagine President Obama is looking forward to this meeting very much. I don't think this is like any other transition of power. It's not like handing the government from George Bush, who was a traditional Republican, to Barack Obama, who was a traditional Democrat. This is handing the presidency over from a historic leader, the first African-American president, to a guy who has absolutely no experience. Far and away, the least qualified person to ever become president of the United States. So this is uncharted territory. We really have no idea how it's going to go. It could be a well-oiled machine like Scott Walker's Wisconsin, where they pass a lot of very radical things quite quickly and get their entire policy checklist done. Go after unions, go after voting rights, go after all these things, go after the environment, go after women. It could be that, or it could be they want to do that, but then Trump gets in the way and he's so erratic. He had 1 week on the campaign where they took away his Twitter feed and he kept it together, but he's been so erratic during the entire campaign that I think that the well-oiled machine that congressional Republicans want to run is going to run into the personality of Donald Trump, who just can't help himself when it comes to trying to do anything.
Mm-hmm. Professor Dolan.
Well, and I think Ruth made a good point when she said that the Republicans really have to own government now, can't be obstructionist, can't be, you know, sidestepped for, you know, well, the governing wasn't our fault. But their notion of being outsiders. You know, Donald Trump has already floated the names of some people who may or may not populate his cabinet, and he will probably have to surround himself with at least some number of people who are establishment Republicans or at least people who are politicians in some way. He can't possibly just bring simply nothing but his, you know, CEO pals or people from the real world. He's going to have to rely on people who have some experience, and they're going to have to help him navigate the bureaucracy and navigate the relationship with Congress. So it'll be very interesting to see how quickly he himself is no longer an outsider, because he may have to surround himself with people who know much more than he does.
Mm-hmm. Orrin, do you think he can be presidential? Are you worried about that?
Well, I'm certainly worried about that. I think you've seen over the last 2 weeks or so on the campaign trail a concerted effort to behave himself, so to speak. You know, certainly in his victory speech last night, it was not conventional by the standards that, you know, we expect from kind of eloquent
right.
politicians, but it was certainly decent and presentable. So the you know, the question I think on everybody's mind is, to what extent was his approach to campaigning chosen because it turned out to be a very effective way of campaigning, and to what extent it was his approach to campaigning something that won't look any different in the White House, and no one really knows.
Yeah. I had people over at my house last night, and we were mentioning, somebody talked about David Clark earlier, that maybe Homeland Security, which is a possibility, and I was wondering about Sarah Palin, because she campaigned for a little bit, and somebody in the room said, how about ambassador to Russia, because she can see Russia from her house. That is something you could see happening. I mean, you could, right?
Yeah,
you could.
Sure.
Ari, you've talked about voter suppression really being an underreported story of 2016, and I know you did extensive work in North Carolina. What's the latest on what was going on in North Carolina?
Sure. So just to remind your listeners, Kathleen, this was the first presidential election in 50 years without the full protections of the Voting Rights Act. And I think lots of the media missed the significance of this story. 14 states, including Wisconsin, had new voting restrictions in place for the first time in this election. North Carolina was one of the states where we saw a bunch of new restrictions, things like voter ID laws, cuts to early voting, eliminating same-day registration. Much of this was overturned by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, which found that the state targeted black voters with almost surgical precision. But there was still an effort in North Carolina to limit the number of polling places during early voting. For example, there was only one early voting site for many counties with a large number of black voters. Black turnout was way down in North Carolina during this period. When there were more early voting locations, black turnout went up, but it still lagged in the state relative to what Hillary Clinton needed. Wisconsin, where I was yesterday on Election Day, was another state with lots of problems with their voter ID law. I was with a guy who was 99 years old.
I saw that. Rode his bicycle,
story.
Right?
This amazing guy who was 99 years old, looked great. He was a UW professor. He designed propellers during World War II. He was an engineer, and he rode his bike to the polls. He always votes at the same place in elementary school where he reads to kindergartners. But this time, for the first time in his life, his ID was not accepted. They would not let him vote with his University of Wisconsin faculty ID card, because that is not an accepted ID under Wisconsin's voter ID law. So the poll workers, who all knew him, in the past they could have vouched for him, but they had to call Molly McGrath of Vote Riders, who was helping people get voter IDs. She had to take him to the DMV. He had to go back to the polls. He was luckily able to vote, but this 99-year-old man had to make two trips to the polls and one trip to the DMV to be able to vote, just 1 month short of his 100th birthday. And these stories are crazy. And I told another story of a couple who was 85 and 86 years old, who've lived in the same house for 64 years and been married for 64 years in Plymouth, Wisconsin. And the wife was denied the ability to vote during early voting because her driver's license was expired. And that was the only Wisconsin government-issued photo ID she had. They told her to go to the DMV in Sheboygan, which was about 25 minutes away. She's a cancer survivor. She said, I don't want to do that. It's too much for me. And her husband was so angry, he didn't vote either. And they were both Democrats. They said they, if they voted, they were going to vote for Hillary Clinton. So we can't quantify how many people decided that they tried to vote and they couldn't, how many people just didn't show up in the first place, how many people had to make multiple trips to the polls. But this was certainly an issue in Wisconsin.
And it's one of those issues you can't imagine really an easing of restrictions on voting, considering how the Supreme Court is going to change, right?
This is, to me, the most significant aspect of the election, that Democrats had a chance to take control of the Supreme Court for the first time in 50 years since Earl Warren was Chief Justice with the death of Antonin Scalia. Republicans blocked it in the Senate. The hope was that Hillary Clinton would win and she would be able to appoint either Merrick Garland or another Supreme Court justice to give Democrats a 5-4 majority. Then Ruth Bader Ginsburg might retire so they could shore up the left flank of the court. Now Donald Trump is going to name, in his words, the next Antonin Scalia. So the Supreme Court's moving back to the right. They could further gut the Voting Rights Act. They could strengthen things like voter ID laws. So all the stuff that I've been writing about, unfortunately, I'm very concerned it's going to get a whole lot worse.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to some phone calls. We have a lot of people waiting to talk to all of you. Mary in Milwaukee, hi.
Hello. Well, I would just like to say that the dumbing down of America has finally come to fruition.
How so, Mary? What dumbing down in terms of language?
Well, I'll give you a good example. This morning, a man called On Point Radio, and he said that he voted for Trump. He didn't really want to, but he voted for Trump because he was scared. He was concerned about the security issues of our country and that a woman president would make us look weak, which I think is ridiculous, and it shows you that the rhetoric is working. But look at England, for example. They have had a Queen Elizabeth for, what, almost a century?
Was there a concern, do you think? Let's go to you first on this, Oren, to elect a woman as president, that there was some sexism here, was there?
I don't think that's very likely. I think if you actually look, Clinton did appoint worse with women than Obama did 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's hard to conclude from that.
She also did 4 points worse with men.
Hmm. Oh, absolutely.
Also, women participate in sexism. I mean, the
idea that
demonstrates anything, I think, is somewhat dubious.
Well, look, if you want to get to the point where you're kind of your key hypothesis here is that, you know, women didn't want a woman president and on, you can, you know, and then we throw in the vote rigging and irregularities, and you can kind of from the left spin as many objections to the outcome as everyone was worried people were going to spin from the right. At the end, Clinton did worse than Obama did with women. She also did worse with Latinos and African Americans.
Right, she did.
And so this was a pretty widespread failing on the part of her campaign. You know, obviously these were two very flawed candidates, and I think everyone's a little bit surprised by where it came out, but I think it's hard to conclude that something like sexism was the driver of it.
She did not very well. She only won by 6 points. She was supposed to win by 30 points among college-educated white women in this country. What happened?
Well, you know, there really is no evidence that women vote for women simply because they're women, and nobody here is trying to make the argument that she won or lost because of her sex. But there are patterns. We did see significant roll-off in white Democratic men voted for her less in fewer numbers than they did for President Obama. Men overall voted for her less often. She did also do 1 point worse among women. She didn't do as well as expected among certain groups of women. There's very little evidence that her sex really drove any of the decisions here. There really are two sort of different directions. One is the fraying of the Obama coalition. The racial minorities and young people did not turn out for her in the same numbers and in significantly lower numbers than they did in 2012. Mm-hmm. And then also the sort of, you know, blue-collar, less well-educated, more men than women who, you know, in that Midwestern belt who really voted for Trump.
But what happened to the, I think one of her, Ruth, most effective ads was this young children listening to the rhetoric of Donald Trump where he talks about grabbing by the and the blood coming out of everywhere and fat people and one, you know, it was a very effective ad with children looking at the television and it gave you pause. What happened to the female vote? Would you vote against somebody who said those kinds of things. Did that stir women to vote for Hillary Clinton or not? Would it?
Really? Well, I think that was when she surged. And I think mm-hmm. that at that point in the race, we shifted from a race that was about a very populist moment in politics where the Democratic candidate who represented that populist strain that really drove the election this year was gone. We had a centrist candidate who was a total mismatch for this election year. And then we had the right-wing populism of Donald Trump. But the sexism thing really gave Hillary some of the juice she lacked as a corporate centrist. The problem is, then we had the rerun of the email controversy, and it just killed her momentum at the end of the race. I think, I think James Comey may have decided the outcome of the election. I mean, not so much because, as it turned out, there was no substance to it, not so much because that itself was such a big issue, but because it muddied the waters, and it reminded people that they were unenthusiastic about both candidates, instead of having this clear contrast that I think Hillary really drew with Trump on this sexism issue.
Yeah.
But I also want to say on the issue of misogyny and the role that it played in this race, this is the difference between right-wing populism and left-wing populism. In right-wing populism, where people feel really angry and disaffected, as they have in Wisconsin, and as Walker has so effectively exploited with his divide-and-conquer strategy, people look at their neighbor. They don't like the teachers and the firefighters. And sticking it to those people turns out to be a big driver of their vote. And in the same way with the Donald Trump campaign, sticking it to immigrants and black people and women, reasserting the idea that really insecure, anxious, white working class voters are going to have their greatness restored. We're going to have white supremacy again. We're going to have male dominance again. That, I think, psychologically played a major role. So it's very hard to untangle the legitimate grievances mm-hmm. of the group of people who voted mm-hmm. for Donald Trump from the targeting of people, women, minorities, immigrants, which is, that's the problem with right-wing populism.
Yeah. There was a very moving thing said. We were watching mostly CNN last night, although going to Fox and MSNBC and bumping all over the place. But Van Jones is an analyst on CNN. Some of you may have heard this. There's a lot of retweeting or reposting of this on Facebook today, who was a Bernie Sanders supporter and became a supporter of Hillary Clinton. But he talked about, and I think it's important to discuss this today because of some of the rhetoric that came from Donald Trump concerning Muslims, concerning people who are here illegally. And you've got to believe today and after yesterday, they are nervous. And there was an element of our common humanity that wasn't on display. And he expressed the concerns that they may be feeling. I want to play this and then have everybody respond to this because I do think it's important. Here's Van Jones, CNN analyst, last night.
There's another side to this. People have talked about a miracle. I'm hearing about a nightmare. It's hard to be a parent tonight for a lot of us. You tell your kids, don't be a bully. You tell your kids, don't be a bigot. You tell your kids, do your homework and be prepared. And then you have this outcome, and you have people putting children to bed tonight, and they're afraid of breakfast. They're afraid of, how do I explain this to my children? I have Muslim friends who are texting me tonight saying, should I leave the country? I have families of immigrants that are terrified tonight. This was many things. This was a rebellion against the elites. True, it was a complete reinvention of politics and polls, it's true. But it was also something else. We've talked about race. I mean, we've talked about everything but race tonight. We've talked about income. We've talked about class. We've talked about region. We haven't talked about race. This was a white lash. This was a white lash against a changing country. It was a white lash against a black president in part. And that's the part where the pain comes. And Donald Trump has a responsibility tonight to come out and reassure people that he is going to be the president of all the people who he insulted and offended and brushed aside. Yeah, when you say, you want to take your country back, you got a lot of people who feel that we're not represented well either. But we don't want to feel that someone has been elected by throwing away some of us to appeal more deeply to others. So this is a deeply painful moment tonight. I know it's not just about race. There's more going on than that. But race is here, too. We got to talk about it.
Well, and whoever wins.
Let's go to Orrin Cass on that. I understand what he's saying. I know there are people who are immigrants. There are Muslims who have been very worried since some of this rhetoric came from Donald Trump. He ran a campaign that was heavy on that. But I want to hear from everybody. But, Orrin, let's start with you. Does he need to calm everybody's fears? Does he need to present more of we're all in this together, we're all Americans?
Well, I think you know I've been second to no one in my criticism of his tone.
I know you have.
And especially some of that rhetoric. And so I would certainly say, again, going forward, that that's something he needs to stop. But I also think it's important to understand what happened in the election, which is that if you look at the exit polls, you know, the groups that shifted most heavily to him were non-white. The vast majority of the gap he closed with Clinton relative to the Romney-Obama class gap came not from white voters, it came from minorities, it came from Latinos, it came from African Americans. And so to look at his election, I think, you know, Van Jones called it a white lash, and folks are talking about it as the kind of the rise of a white supremacy politics and of the victory for racial demagoguery. That's not actually what happened. And so I think it's important to at least recognize that it turns out the electorate in 2016 ended up less racially polarized than in 2012, and that for whatever reason, the message that Trump was putting out there was not just appealing to whites. It actually, at least relative to 4 years ago, was appealing more strongly to other groups of Americans as well.
Kathleen, can I respond
to
that?
Yeah, go ahead, Ari, please.
So if you... I tweeted this last night because if you look at the numbers, the only group of people that Trump won were white voters, which is a consistent theme for Republicans. And he did about as well with white voters as Mitt Romney did. And it's true that Trump did a few percentage points better with black voters and Latinos and Asian Americans, but he still lost these groups overwhelmingly. The only reason he's president, Van Jones is completely right, the only reason Donald Trump is president is because of white voters. He was repudiated by 50 to 60 to 70 to 80 to almost 90% of people of color, if you look at different demographic groups. And this is an incredible shift. If you look back at U.S. history, we had a period of Reconstruction where African Americans could vote. And that was followed after the Civil War by a period called Redemption, where white Southerners wanted to redeem the Confederacy. And I think there's a similar movement at play with the Trump campaign, that we're going from a black president to people that are motivated, in many cases, by antipathy towards people of color, by antipathy towards women, by antipathy towards immigrants and to Muslims. And when Trump said, "Make America Great Again," everyone knew what he was talking about. You didn't have to be a genius. He was saying, "Make America Great Again," meaning that there was a time when it was great, and that was a throwback to a time, in many people's eyes, when there was not such a thing as a black president or a woman president or any of those other possibilities.
Well, he also led a birther movement that went on for a long time, Professor Dolan.
Yes, and I think Ari raises an important point. I mean, when we had a succession of white male presidents, some of the racism, some of the misogyny in our society was probably held a little bit below the surface and at bay. And racism certainly has had 8 years to percolate around the fringes and not the fringes. So I think he's right that we have moved through a period where some people are feeling empowered to try to restore white supremacy. I do think there's a role in the explanation of what happened yesterday for this notion of white anxiety. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that it's a coincidence that we had a campaign on one side that really worked to pit groups against each other, and another candidate whose motto was stronger together.
Yeah.
And so at some level, we were offered a choice. Are we a diverse nation that works together and is stronger together? Or are we groups? And at some level, right, we're seeing the sort of rise again of a group of people who want to return us to a more sort of traditional and time past.
Ruth, to you, then we pause. We'll go to phone calls.
I was in the airport this morning in Chicago on my way back, and there was a woman sitting across from me on the phone, and she was saying, "He's going to build that beautiful wall. Those people don't want to work. You'll see. If he can't get it done now, no one can get it done. And right next to her was a woman in a headscarf and her three little girls. And I just thought, oh, my God. You know, this is really about that for people. It's viscerally about that. And that's what makes it so painful.
We'll take phone calls in a moment. We have many guests with us this hour examining what went on last night. In order of how they last spoke, I think Ruth Conniff, editor-in-chief of the Progressive magazine, Kathleen Dolan, professor and chair of political science department at UW-Milwaukee, Orrin Cass, Ari is the senior contributing writer for The Nation magazine in Madison, looking at voting in Wisconsin. He's the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Orrin Cass, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, who was domestic policy director of Mitt Romney's presidential campaign in 2011-2012. Our number is 800-486-8655. More phone calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to some phone calls because we're almost out of time. There's just too much to talk about. Josie in Sheboygan. Hi, Josie.
Yes, good afternoon. I wanted to talk about Teflon Don and talk about something that nothing sticks to this man. What nobody talks about, I listen to the competitive radio shows, you know, the conservatives, and to try to get a full picture. And nobody brings up what he's going to do as far as the environment is concerned. We're in our sixth extinction right now, caused by humans.
All right, I need to hold you there. We're short on time. Orrin, has there been enough talk about climate change? Do you anticipate action?
Well, I think Trump has made very clear that he's planning to take the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement and likely undo the Clean Power Plan that President Obama had tried to implement. It didn't get a whole lot of attention during the election because, frankly, it didn't seem like either side really wanted to talk about it. But certainly it is not going to be a priority of his administration going forward.
Thanks, Josie, for your call. Dave in Rothschild, hi.
Hello, this is Dave.
No, you're Dave. Hi, Dave.
Yeah. I just want to make a quick comment that on the Wisconsin level of the race, it was really unfair that Ron Johnson would harp about career politicians, how they just done no good for our economy. But what about Scott Walker? Yeah, what about Paul Ryan? Their whole professional lives have been politicians, and that's okay.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Were you surprised by any of the Senate races here? What was... the Republicans got what they needed to get. It's going to be in one party control. Professor Dolan, were you surprised by that? Was it a Trump down ticket thing that he won so he carried everybody with him or what?
I'm trying to think, you know, going through all the Senate races off the top of my head, but most of the Republican seats that they held were in states that Trump ends up winning. You know, Tammy Duckworth in Illinois is one of the pickups. Maggie Hassan in New Hampshire, maybe she's ahead by about 300 votes right now. And so they held the seats they needed to in the states where Trump was able to flip things. Right, they flipped Pennsylvania, and so they held that seat. Toomey held that seat. They flipped Wisconsin and Ron Johnson. I mean, the Democratic hope for picking up the Senate hinged on Clinton retaining those blue states that had traditionally been in the Democratic column, and then using that assumed, you know, higher Democratic turnout to pick up those Senate seats. And since Trump took many of those states, that certainly did not happen.
Yeah. So let me ask, and we're going to talk about this tomorrow, Ruth, but let me give this to you. Do the Democrats need to become more progressive in order for them? You know, the weird thing is we were talking forever about the Republicans needing to pay attention to their examination of what went wrong in 2012. Now the Democrats have to look at what went wrong here. What's wrong with the Democrats? Are they not progressive enough? Do they not have a lot of candidates running for office? What's going on?
I mean, think back to the Democratic primary campaign and the massive outpouring for Bernie Sanders.
Yes,
and
I remember.
And how unlikely that was. Mm-hmm. I mean, this obscure socialist senator from Vermont bringing out tens of thousands of people, the energy behind that movement, and making some of the same criticisms of income inequality, trade, the flight of manufacturing jobs that Donald Trump then made in the general election. And the Democratic Party stepped in, the professionals took over, and they gave us their institutional candidate. We've been through this before in Wisconsin. We had a massive outpouring to recall Scott Walker. We had historic protests, people in the streets, massive grassroots energy. The professionals took over. We got some not super inspiring candidates who had no connection to that grassroots movement, and they lost. And I think it's really important that the Democrats take a look at what happened here.
But Russ Feingold lost too, right? He was a progressive candidate.
Yeah, I mean, the Feingold race, which looked worse and worse and worse over time.
We have 10 seconds.
Ron Johnson got a, you know, got six times the outside money as Feingold. But Feingold had been gone, and he missed that big moment in Wisconsin. And I think that's part of that story, too.
All right. Thank you all very much for being with us. It was a good hour. Orrin Cass, thank you. Orrin Cass, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, joins us fairly often for all things political. Ari Berman, senior contributing writer for The Nation magazine. Professor Kathleen Dolan, who is professor and chair of the political science department at UW-Milwaukee, and Ruth Conniff, editor-in-chief of the Progressive magazine. Thanks to Scotty Myers and Zeb Gozman and KP Whaley for all of their help.